morning, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. Forgot my headphones. Darn it.
What the heck? You're supposed to be ready to go. Be a professional, please.
Well, okay, so I'm going to have to wing the music. I forgot my headphones. So, my name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Dr. Farrell in Palisades.
Oh,
and we have a commercial.
Then there's Dr. Farrell.
There's Dr. Farrell.
Annual membership.
You get some free airtime there. There we go. Hey, our real sponsor today is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Yeah. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. And they deal in everything John Deere Ag and Turf. So if you need mowers, tractors, implements, you need service for your tractors or parts, go by and see them. They do it all. And don't forget, generator season is coming up. They've got a full line of Honda generators ready to go. And steel products. Get a big windstorm, branches fall down, go buy a chainsaw. They've got them in stock.
And it's not really generator season. It's PG&E is shutting your power off season.
That's right. Get ready to thaw your turkey because it's coming. So anyway, their phone number is 226-9226. And get them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Terrific. Yeah. Okay, so today is Father's Day. Happy Father's Day.
Oh, thank you.
All the dads out there and all the stepdads, because they wind up being the dads too. It's June 21st, 2020, in case we air this later, which I'm sure we will because it's about history. So I think really the emphasis on history is incredibly important now.
Get it while you can, because it's going away.
We're
going to reset the calendar here pretty quick.
God. I just wanted to let people know you can find everything about the show along with archives that are no charge to listen to, and they are commercial free at wethepeopleradio.us. So it has to be We the People Radio. Also include the word radio.us, because We the People, something else is used. So anyway, We the
People. And .us, not .com.
Everything but .com, actually. .net, .biz, .info. You can pick any of those. I own all those.
Not .com.
Some knucklehead has .com and is doing nothing with it. So, anyway, if you go to wethepeopleradio.us and you get nothing, you typed it in wrong. We had a little snag with that a little earlier. We've got some updates from South Africa coming in upcoming weeks. We have updates on China. What's really going on over there. So we'll have our Chinese dissident friends will come on and tell us all about that. And those things are all marked at the top of the page. They have tabs for you so you can get to those programs easily, because it takes a long time to scroll through 10 years of archives.
Yeah.
I don't mean to put everyone through the paces. So you can just go to those tabs at the top and cheat. So our guest today is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. We have he's like our all-around, knows everything about everything. He's like, I don't know. Who is he? He's like the Ace is the Place with the Helpful Hardware Man. we need to make him like his own slogan. He's the executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security and the director of the U.S. Nuclear Strategy Forum. Both are congressional advisory boards. He's served on the Congressional EMP Commission, Electromagnetic Pulse Commission, that we talk about a lot on this show, the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, and the House Armed Services Committee. Dr. Pry was an intelligence officer with the CIA, responsible for analyzing Soviet and Russian nuclear strategy, which is why he knows so much about that, and we pick his brain often. He has a PhD in history and archaeology and another PhD in strategic studies, which is what led him to the CIA. He's the author of numerous books, and his most recent one is The Power and the Light, The Congressional EMP Commission's War to Save America, 2001 to 2020. So the books are actually all listed on the webpage if you go there today. I've got links to all of them and descriptions about all of them, and so we've made fairly short work of your research there. I can't think of anything else. We're talking about history today, so we're going to delve into Dr. Pry's real passion, because every time we talk to him, Cicero comes up. So I always chuckle. I'm like, we should do a show just about the history, and with all this I don't know what you call it, revolution, I guess, and craziness out there. This isn't the first time in history this has happened, as I think everyone is aware, but I'm not sure people really realize the detail.
So, I think it's the first time it's happened in our country where there's been a concerted effort to eliminate our history and rewrite it.
Okay, Bill put all his chips in on that one, so we're going to find out. We're going to find out if he's right or not. So, Dr. Pryor, are you in there?
Yes.
Terrific.
I'm sorry if I was a little late picking up.
That's okay. We're a little late calling you.
They had a Father's Day party for me today.
Nice.
And my birthday was yesterday. So it's sort of a back-to-back celebrations here. And,
Well, happy Father's Day birthday to you.
Well, thank you. history. Well, that's, I used to teach it. I taught at three different colleges and universities when I was young. And it's just to every historian, well, maybe not to every historian, to those who were trained in the classical tradition of history, which probably stopped in the 70s and 80s in this country, maybe in the 80s, when I was going to graduate school. It's heartbreaking. But modern history programs and social science programs, except for, in some, with rare exception, I think, have become radicalized, you know, which is why we have so many of our supposedly educated young people who've really been brainwashed and radicalized themselves into the, you know, Marxist, racist, you know, view of things. But to see them tearing down monuments and so ignorantly understanding, you know, where our society stands in the ranks of former civilizations, you know, the notion that America is evil and that we're an institutionally racist society, when in fact we are the most egalitarian, freest, most prosperous, most opportunity society for all races and ethnic groups that has ever existed. And that is simply a historical fact, and a fact that anyone with common sense can obviously discover, because ethnic groups from all over the world, people of all races and creeds, want to come here, and we even have to build a wall to keep them out. They don't come here just legally, but they want to come here illegally. Why would they do that if they didn't think it was in their interests, and if it was if we were really like Nazi Germany or something like that?
If we were the fascists that they say we are.
Yeah, they wouldn't be breaking down the doors to get in.
Said the people with the guns making a fake town in Seattle, yeah.
Right. The people aren't beating down the doors to get into China or to get into North Korea or to get into Russia or into any of these socialist societies. And nor can you find any other country outside of Africa that has elected a black to be their president and done so twice. No, I think Barack Obama was the worst president in our history. I'm not particularly proud of him as a president, okay? But I am proud that we have a civilization that's capable of looking past race,
right,
you know, to elect someone to be president. And he kind of got elected on false grounds, because at least his first election was based on his rhetoric was very post-racial. And, let's get more into, and before I depart our current circumstances and we go backwards in time, I can't resist making one more point. You know, I was toying, when I was thinking about this show that we were going to talk about and the events going on in the country, and how we're supposed to be such a racist society and everything. I remember, because I think of when I was in graduate school, back in the early 80s, that's when the turn came. That's when, you know, you still had some conservative professors left who understood, you know, the classical historical tradition, but the university was clearly being taken over by the left. I remember, back in the early 80s, that as a graduate student, if you were a conservative, you know, the conservative professors were cowed and hiding under their desks, basically, and afraid to speak up. And the left wing was the leftists and the radical feminists and the like were all out there, very bold and as brass, so getting away with murder so that they would, for example, if you were a conservative, they would they would take away your on a scholarship. They would try to take away your scholarship, okay, to make sure only left-wing people had those. And tried to do it to me, as a matter of fact, at one time. But didn't succeed, fortunately. That's another story. But one of the books that was required reading, if you were studying history or social science, and maybe it probably still required reading in these universities, was a book called Soul on Ice by Eldridge Cleaver. And Eldridge Cleaver was a 60s Black Panther, black nationalist, you know, deeply racist because he hated whitey. His book is, he was a communist. You know, his book was just as rabid, even perhaps more so even, than the attitudes that you find among Black Lives Matters and Antifa. You know, he felt it was, in his book, he describes it being perfectly justifiable to rob and white people and rape white women. You know, they have it coming to them. There's no bad thing that the black race could do to the white race because of all the sins of the white race. And at some point along the line of the Black Panthers, he got involved in a crime. Don't remember if it was a murder of a policeman or a robbery or something like that to support their radical activities, but it forced him into exile. He fled the country to, and gladly, by the way, to go to the Soviet Union and Communist China, various totalitarian systems where he lived for a number of years, serving as a mouthpiece for them, you know, denouncing the United States and the West, and discovered what those places were really like, and became so shocked, so appalled, and himself, because they, of course, ended up in those societies nobody is trusted, and he found himself under more scrutiny and oppression than anything he imagined possible.
Imagine that.
Imagine that.
And he actually redefected to the United States. He escaped to the U.S. Embassy, even willing to face prison if necessary.
To escape.
Yeah, to escape socialism, communism, to escape the workers' paradise. And we took him back.
Hold that thought. We'll do a cliffhanger there. Got to take a really quick break. Speaking of capitalism, that means we have to communism. We have to take a capitalism break. So we'll be back in 2 minutes. Our guest is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You're listening to We the People. You can join us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
When they move into your neighborhood, they take over, but good. You all body and soul, then it's just your body, then they go. What shall we do about them?
Yes, because it's against the law, and out here, you must wear a mask, unless you don't want to, in which case, what are they going to do? Hold you down and strap it to your face? I'm going to find out what they do at the airport on Thursday. I'll let you know when I get back how that worked out for me.
Yeah, you better keep one in your back pocket.
Yeah.
You can only press it so hard.
I wonder if a Post-it note would work. I could just hook it on my nose, be hanging down. That's like a face covering, right?
I'd go with the Batman mask.
They all say face covering. Saw a guy yesterday in church. It went like all the way down to his shirt. So I'm not sure what kind of pollution comes out of your neck, but apparently apparently he was saving us from his neck pollution. But I digress. Sorry. Okay, go back to Dr. Pry. Sorry about that.
Not at all.
We should never
you
take breaks.
Always so funny.
Makes me squirrely.
I'd rather listen to you than listen to me. maybe you should spend 2 hours just
talking about nothing,
comedy or something. Anyway, going back to Eldridge Cleaver, we were talking about the 1960s, 70s, Black Panther, communist, black nationalist. you know, one of the things he believed too was, you know, he wanted to. His dream was to have the blacks take over the old Confederacy. The states of the United States had been the old Confederacy, and break off from the mainland, from the United States, and that would become a black-dominated independent nation. Because, you know, he didn't think blacks and whites could live together either. But as I said, he escaped, quote unquote, from our country to the socialist paradise of, you know, the Soviet Union and their other totalitarian, authoritarian, socialist Cuba. Lived there for many years and discovered that they were really nightmarish societies, far worse than anything he imagined. And he, not the paradises that he believed in. In fact, and they were also themselves deeply. Far real, he encountered real racism and real oppression there, living in 1984 type societies, and you know, redefected to the United States, escaped to the U.S. Embassy. I don't even think he had to serve any prison time, but we took him back. He literally kissed the ground when he. When the plane came back to the United States, got off on the tarmac and kissed the ground when he arrived. He became a Christian and a conservative Republican and ran for Congress, and unfortunately wasn't elected. The new Eldridge Cleaver, I would have voted for him. And I say that because he wrote another book that they never tell you about in graduate school called Soul on Fire, which I remember I had read that book when I was in graduate school, and we were compelled to read Soul on Ice. And the professor didn't even know about Soul on Fire. You know, the only book they care about, and the one that they foist upon their students, is the one critical of the United States that represents us as a institutionally racist, evil country, Cleaver's first book. They don't write his conversion book, the one that he wrote when he was older and wiser. And had actually lived in these countries, and changed his mind, changed his soul, and became a Christian and a conservative. Soul on Fire. And that book should be required reading for Black Lives Matters and Antifa and of all of our modern, you know, students. But that wasn't taught when I went to school, and it's probably... They probably still have it, you know, deeply, deeply buried and ignored it because, of course, it doesn't support the left-wing narrative. And I guess it's consistent with what G.K. Chesterton once said of socialism, you know, which is anybody who is not a socialist in their 20s has no heart, but anyone who is still a socialist in their 30s has no brain. Now, I guess to transition to talking about history, and although that is a form of history, since we are talking about matters that happened 30, 40 years ago with Eldridge Cleaver and the rest. But if we go back to, we were going to talk about political violence in history and in democracies, and this is one of the, in ancient Athens was a, riven with political violence, which is one of the reasons the founders didn't like democracy, something a lot of Americans don't understand. We often describe our system of government as a democracy, but it isn't. You know, a democracy is a condition where the people vote on everything. You know, you don't have representative government, you know, where you have representatives that you have voted for who then vote on laws and the like. It was direct representation by the people themselves. And that sounds appealing to a lot of people today. That's why they want to get rid of the Electoral College, you know, and have the president elected, you know, by a direct vote and all that. But the founders hated democracy. They thought it was a great evil because of the history of Athens, and they were right. You know, democracies, Athens as a democracy lasted less than a century. You know, it's very subject to demagoguery. It's very hard to stay the course. You know, as soon as the public starts feeling pain from some policy, a demagogue will come up who has who is an enemy of the existing elite who's running the thing and appeal to the people, you know, to overthrow the existing system and put in a new system and take a completely new direction. And if you look at the, and this was especially true of Athens, and the thing that became fatal to them was this failing of democracy during the Peloponnesian War. Thucydides wrote the history of the Peloponnesian War. He had been an Athenian general, and he himself was deeply critical of the problems with trying to fight a war against the Spartans under conditions of democracy. You know, because the strategies would zigzag, they couldn't stay the course, generals would be exiled or even executed, you know, if they became unpopular or failed in one campaign. And these failings eventually doomed Athens in the war with Sparta, which was not a democracy, and so they went down in defeat. So our system of government, the founders were great students of classical history, and you know, Athens was one of the polar stars that they looked to for the kinds of mistakes that were made in the past that we try to avoid in our system. That's why we're not really a democracy. We're a republic. You know, in a republic, you know, the difference is that the people vote for representatives who then go in and debate and pass laws on the behalf of the people. And the representatives are supposed to be elected, you know, based on the fact that they are successful, you know, that they are usually more experienced than the average person, presumably, you know, better schooled in law and politics and history and wisdom. And they are supposed to be leaders that people look up to. And that doesn't sound like I'm describing our Congress, does it? you know, so unfortunately, maybe that's one of our failings. But that's what we started off with. That's what the founders believed. And if you look at past Congresses, you know, the Congresses of not in the modern era, you know, there does seem to be quite a difference between the kinds of people who were elected to the Senate and the House of Representatives back in the good old days, you know, who did fit that kind of definition.
And a different...
Men of accomplishment, men of education, honest people who are not corrupt. Usually, that's one of the reasons, in fact, that it's gone away now, but in our early Constitution, you had to be a man of property. You had to have property, or you had to be relatively wealthy. That's considered a great evil in the era of populism, you know, that you would have be accomplished in that way. But they saw it as a safeguard against corruption, because if you were already rich, that proved that you were successful at something in life, and it would also help insulate you against being subject to bribery.
Yeah, exactly.
And now you're just bad. Now you got to get rid of you. We have to take another really quick break. We'll be back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and we have him as a hostage here on Father's Day for 2 full hours. Thank you so much. You can find everything about the show at wethepeopleradio.us.
Rockefeller, Campanella, Communist Bloc, Roy Khan, Juan Perón, Tuscanini, Dacron, Din, Din, Foo Falls, Rock Around the Clock.
Billy Joel should get big props for that.
Yeah, that's a great song.
Yeah, that's like just a little piece of it. See, he rattles all that off, and you can actually understand him. He's obviously old, because now everybody sounds like... They all sound like they have masks on. Maybe that's why they like the masks.
Yeah.
Because those old people are like, can you just enunciate, please?
Take that damn mask off.
Never fails. All right. Sorry. Back to you, Dr. Brock.
You guys have a real genius for choosing songs for the subject matter that we're discussing.
Thank you.
I wonder how many people out there in BLM or in Antifa actually know who Albert Einstein is, but
asking a lot.
We had left off with why the founders had wanted, had a property test or a wealth test that they expected members of the Congress and the Senate to be men of wealth or property as a safeguard against corruption, and also as to provide some insurance that the people who would serve in those roles were successful at something and therefore, you know, might be competent. But there was another important reason for that. Because if you were successful, if you had a private enterprise, you were a successful merchant or had a big plantation or something of that sort, and that's where your wealth was, and that's what your chief goal in your private life was about, then your service in the Senate or the Congress was more likely to be genuinely a matter of public service, because it was going to cost you, you know, to leave your business and to come and serve in Congress. And it would also help be a safeguard against the possibility of the development of a perpetual aristocracy like we have today, you know, where a person becomes a member of the Congress or a member of the Senate, and they make a career of it and stay there forever. You know, throughout most of our history, it wasn't that way. You know, people wanted, out of a sense of public service, to be a congressman or a senator for a short while and then return to their private life, which is where their real success was. That was the theory, and it worked for a long time. Now, the second big example, you know, of our founders looked to for an example of a free system, you know, governed by consent of the people, you know, was, of course, the Roman Republic. You know, after the fall of Athens, centuries after the fall of Athens and the Peloponnesian War, the next one, you know, is the Roman Republic. You know, that lasted almost until the birth of Christ, you know, for a period of about 500 years, and so it was quite successful, but it wasn't a democracy. This was a Republican form of government, and you know, so that you had a Senate that comprised the wealthier part of the and the more successful part, people who had military backgrounds as well, people who were greatly accomplished, the most educated classes. But the plebeian class was also represented. That is kind of the equivalent of the working class, the lower class, you know, by tribunes who served in the Senate, who had great power. A tribune could veto a bill, you know, that the Senate passed. And so everybody within the society had some kind of representation. You know, obviously it was heavily skewed toward the elites, you know, but the people had a lot of power through their tribunes and through political violence, you know, because people, when things went bad, there were a lot of riots in Rome, you know, over matters that they didn't like. If the plebeians felt that they weren't getting their fair share, or that the Senate was tending toward a tyranny or something of that sort, you know, everybody was, all the classes were concerned about going back to being a king. Rome had started off as a kingship, and they didn't even rule over themselves. You know, they were, you know, Rome had sort of been started off as the guests of the Tuscans, and they were lorded over by a different group. But they got rid of those kings and established their first republic. And all of the classes didn't want to go back to that, or at least not for 500 years. So that's a good long stretch. especially compared to democratic Athens. So the founders, looking at that fact, you know, said, well, you know, Republican systems seem to be more stable, and they are more fair to more people in terms of providing representation. But even here, you know, the Roman Republic didn't last forever, and it eventually fell prey to becoming an imperial system ruled by an emperor, which is even worse than a king. You know, a king, at least, is just a mortal, but an emperor is supposed to be divine. And, you know, that happened, you know, well, in a nutshell, it was very hard. The Roman Republic worked well when it was pretty much confined to Italy before it became an empire. And probably the beginning of the end for them was were the Punic Wars, when Rome had to fight this, basically it was the equivalent of a world war in the known world at the time. There were three great Punic Wars that lasted over a period of more than a century between Rome and Carthage, you know, which was a rival growing empire in North Africa. And in fact, the future of Western civilization was on the line, because if Carthage had won, the future of the West would be very different. Our civilization would have been rooted in Asiatic traditions instead of the Greek and Roman European type traditions. Everyone probably knows about the great Carthaginian general Hannibal, you know, who was the one who came closest to destroying the Roman Republic. Seemed unbeatable, but in order to prevail in that war, they had to mobilize their resources to fight this, you know, lengthy, multi-generational world war against the Carthaginian Empire. And by the end of it, the armies of Rome were professionalizing. So they had been, one of the things that was stabilizing and kept the Roman Republic a republic was the fact that most of the Romans didn't live in cities. You know, the people who voted were farmers, small farmers. But these were the very people who had to serve in the armies. And in order to keep the armies in the field, eventually they had professional armies. And so people didn't make their living. The small farmers became soldiers and were kept in the army permanently and ended up making their living there as professional soldiers. And as Rome had all these territories that it conquered in the conquest of winning the Punic Wars, you know, it had to maintain this empire, and it became an imperial system, an imperial system where, you know, a lot of their power and wealth, you know, was based on conquering and taking over the wealth of other countries and opening them up for trade agreements and deals where Roman merchants would predominate, and the farms that used to be farmed by Romans ended up being taken over by the wealthy senators. So senators ended up having these vast tracts of land that were farmed by slaves and not by free Romans anymore. And once you had the people basically militarized and serving in the army, you know, it put the power into the hands of the generals in the end of the day, regardless of what the Roman quote-unquote constitution said and the traditions of Rome said. You know, the fact was that if you were a general and you had you were able to win the plebeians over to your side by bread and circuses, the plebeians living in Rome, you know, you could position yourself to basically set yourself up as a king, what eventually became an emperor, which is why Julius Caesar was assassinated. You know, he was perceived by the Roman Senate quite correctly, you know, as basically a person who was on the verge of making himself a king. In fact, he was the dictator of Rome. The Senate voted him that, and he, in effect, before his death, had deconstructed, you know, what had been the Roman Republic. I mean, it existed only in name, and did continue to exist in name throughout the period of Imperial Rome. But in fact, the Senate was pretty powerless and just a a toy of the emperor's. It was a vestigial remnant of the past to convince the people that they still had some influence and that things had not changed. But in fact, they were being run by one man, by the emperor, and that turned out, the first emperor turned out to be Octavian, who was the nephew of Julius Caesar. And there was one more huge cataclysmic civil war to decide that between Octavian and Mark Antony and Cleopatra. With, again, the future of Western civilization was at stake, because if Mark Antony and Cleopatra had won, the roots of Western, we would probably have been governed out of Alexandria, Egypt, and the roots of our civilization would have been coming out of the East instead of out of the West. Although I've always been sympathetic to Cleopatra, particularly, you know, she had the vision, same kind of vision that Alexander the Great had, which was that the Roman Empire should be a cosmopolitan society, not a collection of conquered people, but that everybody, the notion of Roman citizenship should be extended to everybody. And Octavian did embrace that idea. He basically stole it from Cleopatra and became, when he became the Emperor Augustus, the month August is named after him. And he was the first Roman emperor, and prevailed over, he began this period called Pax Romana, where for about 200 years there were no major wars, a lot of minor ones, but no major serious, you know, world war epic struggles anymore.
That's usually where the problems come, no war for a while.
Yeah, people get bored.
Kind of resembling that these days. We have to take one really quick break here before the top of the hour. Our guest is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and you are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
I just ordered up a beer and sat down at the bar when some guy walked in and said, "Who owns this car with the peace sign and the mag wheels and four on the floor?" Well, he looked at me and I damn near died, and I decided that I'd just wait outside. So I laid a dollar on the bar and headed for the door. Just when I thought I'd get out of there with my skin, these five big dudes come. This man has gone as far as tearing Wallace stickers off the bumpers of cars, and he voted for George McGovern for president. Well, he's a friend of them long-haired hippie-type pinko fags. I bet you he's even got a commie flag tacked up on the wall inside of his garage. He's a snake in the grass, I tell you guys. He may look dumb, but that's just a disguise. He's a mastermind in the ways of espionage. They all started looking real.
I need to get a longer cut on that, because then the guy says he doesn't have a garage.
You're bad.
I keep forgetting that part gets cut off. You don't get the whole story. All right, sorry. Back to Cleopatra. I was going to play Walk Like an Egyptian, and then...
Oh, too bad.
That's, yeah, I know. I had it all ready, and then I changed my mind at the last minute.
Well, it's not really that relevant to Cleopatra. But so what lessons did the founders learn from the Roman Republic? Well, first, more than almost anything, they feared the centralization of power, because they correctly saw that, that was the great flaw in the Roman Republic, that, you know, when you, the small farmholders and the small landholders who lived outside of the city of Rome, you know, were a great counterbalance to the Senate becoming, you know, too powerful, and to government becoming too powerful. And they feared the centralization of power both in a particular city or capital, as well as the centralization of that power in the hands of the executive, you know, someone who would be a king or an emperor, you know, because if that person acquired enough power, he could use it to give favors to the lower classes, to the classes, to the poor, and to the plebeians, and basically use that to make civil war or to make a nonviolent overthrow of the republican system, you know, so that the Senate, the legislative part, would become irrelevant. You know, people would give their loyalty to that one man, the man on the white horse, you know, who was able to dispense favors and money and power. And likewise, the centralization of power into the one part of a society like that, like in a city of Rome, would create the basis for creating an imperial system you know, where the hinterlands, everybody else that belonged to that empire would be dominated and possibly, you know, and persecuted by it, exploited by it, you know, so that the people who lived and dominated the bubble that was Rome, you know, everybody else would basically be enslaved to serving its interests. And that was to be avoided. Another big lesson for them was you must control the military. You know, for the military to become independent of the civilian authority, you know, was a great danger to the existence of a free system, a republican system, or a democratic system, any kind of a free system. And that's why the president is commander-in-chief in our system. And we get so upset, you know, whenever generals start speaking out or any military officers start getting extremely political and start speaking out against the commander-in-chief. You know, this is one of the things the founders feared most, that our system would self-destruct. You know, not that we would be conquered from the outside. You know, in the 1700s, you know, we were protected by the Atlantic and Pacific. The idea of a power, we had just defeated Britain. You know, that was one of the greatest military powers in the world at the time, and so we were pretty confident we could defend our own shores from a foreign invaders. The founders had no conception of nuclear weapons and ICBMs and biological weapons, which has changed that part of the calculus in terms of the danger that foreign states pose to us. But they are still right that one of the greatest, perhaps they're still completely right, that the single greatest threat to us is ourselves, is the failure to be a vigilant and educated citizenry who... We're not supposed to trust government. We're supposed to watch government like a hawk, because it's supposed to be the biggest threat to our freedom, that it will get too much power and be able to, and we're not supposed to trust Washington, you know, because that's where our power is concentrated. And the Washington bubble, you know, can become, most Americans, I think, believe it has become, you know, the locus of our elites, and that we've basically got a new imperial system where Washington is the new Rome, and the states of the United States are the conquered empire, that most of our population, the tax policies, the policies that come out of Rome serve the interests of the elites in Washington, not the people who belong to the United States. And that our interests are subordinate to their interests, which, when it's supposed to be the other way around. You know, that's why in the Constitution, we try to, and in the structure of our government, federalism is supposed to be a small f, not a big f. You know, federalism is supposed to be tempered by states' rights. And in the early, in the Constitution, in the original understanding of it, most governance of people's lives was supposed to come from the states. You know, the state governments were closer to people, the closer to their lives. And people had more control over who served in their state government. And they knew the people better who served in their state government. And that was the way the system was supposed to work. Most governments would be coming out of Washington, would be there for national defense and for managing relations between the states. But Washington wasn't supposed to be the main engine driving the way that whole nation is governed the way it is today. And that is what the Civil War was all about. You know, it really, a recent thing, that a statement, an event I found very depressing, was when a man I really respect, Bob Gates, you know, who has served under many administrations, and Republican and Democrat, and has served as Secretary of Defense and the Director of the CIA. So he's one of our elites. He's one of the, supposed to be one of the best and brightest of our elites. But Bob Gates wants to tear down the Confederate statues too, and he wants to not name military bases after Confederate generals, who he describes as traitors.
What?
And in that one statement of Bob Gates, it proves that even Bob Gates, even one of our best and brightest elites, has forgotten American history, doesn't know American history. You know, I'm sure this will be controversial now, and I'll be completely blacklisted in what I'm about to say because it's so politically incorrect. But, you know, the Confederate generals and the soldiers who served in the Confederacy were not traitors to the Constitution. They were not. They had a different understanding of what the Constitution was. You know,
and that's been completely skipped in the, you know, in the current teaching of history.
States' rights, and frankly, and a lot of historians who are intelligent ones, the good ones, who understand the Civil War, and if you read, you know, modern histories, preferably the ones written in the last century, not the ones coming out of universities now. By the last century, I mean the 20th century. God, that makes me feel old, speaking of the last century. The states never would have joined. They never would have joined into a union if they thought they were surrendering their sovereignty. You know, I think it was a better reading of the Constitution that the states thought they had the right to secede under the Constitution and under their historical understanding of how the Constitution was crafted and all the rest. They thought they had the right to secede. And what they thought they were, that one of the chief, that's the chief thing they were fighting for. They were fighting for states' rights, for their sovereignty, for the right to govern themselves by their state governments. And they identified with their states. They felt that they owed their fealty and loyalty to their states first, not to the Union. You know, that's why somebody like a Robert E. Lee, you know, who was really torn between his loyalty to the Union, to the federal government, and his loyalty to his state. But most Americans, certainly in the South, felt that way and thought that way. Not just felt that way, but thought that way, too. You know, that their first loyalty was to their state. And the intellectual basis, you know, for what the North called the rebellion, you know, and what the South has called the war between the states, and now we call it the Civil War, you know, was over a difference between the interpretation of the Constitution, and I personally believe the South had the theory right. You know, their lost cause resulted in the loss. The Constitution, the original Constitution, was in effect destroyed during the Civil War. You know, and what we came out of that with that Civil War was the United States as we think of it today, as a united system, but really it's an imperial system run out of Washington, where the power is centralized in Washington, and where the states' rights were greatly diminished, both after the Civil War and in every decade since, have been cut back and diminished almost to nothing, you know, which is why it's a little surprising, actually, that the left today is getting away with states' rights arguments when it comes to sanctuary cities.
Well, they're also getting away with, you know, no...
It's supposed to have been resolved, but I'm sorry.
Yeah, they're also getting away with no free speech and all sorts of things. We have to take a break here for the news, and we're going to come back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and you are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Let me lock you in ground.